listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. And today I'm excited because I'm talking to Dr. April Sizemore-Barber about prismatic performances, queer South Africa, and the fragmentation of the Rainbow Nation, which was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2020. Prismatic Performances focuses on the queer embodiments that both reveal and animate the gaps between South Africa's self-image and its lived realities. It argues that performance has become a key location where contradictions inherent to South Africa's post-apartheid identity are negotiated. It also shows that, as the sheen of the new South Africa began to fade, these performances revealed the inadequacy and, indeed, the violence of the Rainbow Nation as an aspirational metaphor. Yet they also created space for imagining new, radical configurations of belonging. I forgot to mention this on some of my previous interviews, but this book is part of the amazing Triangulations Lesbian, Gay, Queer Theater Drama Performance Series by the University of Michigan Press. And I have interviewed the authors and editors of some of the other books in the series, and you can check those out in the NBN catalog if you'd like. Interviews included books such as Queer Nightlife, The Bodies of Others, Drag Dances and Their Afterlives, and Translocas, The Politics of Puerto Rican Drag and Trans Performance. Dr. April Sizemore-Barber is Associate Professor of the Practice in Women's and Gender Studies at Georgetown University. April, welcome to New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited at the opportunity to discuss the book and you know, be in conversation with you.
But before we begin, I have a content warning. At some point in this interview, we will discuss sexual violence and rape. But let's get to it. Let's start, April, can you tell us your book's origin story?
Sure. So I've always been really interested in, was a theater person many, many years ago, and always very interested in how theater and performance allow and participate in larger social movements. So I was very interested in the anti-apartheid movement and South Africa's transition from the apartheid era to its new constitutional democracy, and particularly the role that protest theater played and also theater around the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So this is my undergrad, taking us back a while. But I was really, I found myself fascinated particularly with this paradox where South Africa has, unlike the U.S., where we tend to, and other places in the world, where you tend to, law kind of follows popular opinion, South Africa has a constitution that has included LGBT rights as part of its Bill of Rights in its 1996 constitution. And so LGBT identity is part of the literal constitution of the nation, both literal and kind of metaphorical. And so marriage equality, which is, of course, one of those barometers, has been legal since 2005. And very much this narrative of this multicultural, diverse, post-apartheid rainbow nation, which came from Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, has been based around, or queerness has been built into it. And there's a huge queer tourism industry. But it's also very, very clear that the law can only be accessed by those who have economic and cultural kind of the wherewithal. And a lot of people are still, I mean, it's the most unequal society in the world. And I was noticing that there's a certain amount of pinkwashing going on where this rainbow was bolstered by this idea that, you know, yay, queer rights. But actually, the rainbow did not refract equally for everybody. And so I was really interested in how performance, and I define performance very broadly as the interaction between bodies and audiences in particular spaces. I was really interested in how queer bodies in public space kind of required a response, and often that response would be very would be violent, would be, you know, excited, would be any number of things. But it very much there are moments where publics interact with queerness on a kind of South African broad stage, where we can see the failures of the post-apartheid state, but also how queer people themselves creatively engage in their communities through embodiment and critique, and create new ways of being, new ways of imagining a post-apartheid South Africa that is not dictated by a kind of pretty metaphor, but actually thinks about what justice would actually look like.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the time frame that you cover here, 1994 to 2013. I think that's that corresponds to Nelson Mandela's election and death. Why are those dates relevant to the queer South Africans and to the performances you're analyzing here?
Sure. That I kind of consider this time period to be what you might call the rainbow era. So it's from Nelson Mandela's election, which was largely thought to called the kind of the miracle, right? It's part of the state building around all these narratives. So I basically look at the rise and what we might call the rise and fall of this rainbow enthusiasm, and how queer people were part of the nation building within the constitution, and also often are blamed when this transition or the transformation didn't actually occur as people had hoped. LGBT people are scapegoated, and Nelson Mandela is such an iconic figure, and he was one of my first chapters. I look at his relationship to a drag performer, Peter Jerkace, and he's very, very savvy and was very, very much kind of holding things together, even as his successors were not, Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma were kind of, in many people's opinions, selling the democracy down the river by investing in neoliberal politics and the IMF. And a denialism around HIV. But Nelson Mandela would be trotted out at various times for elections, and kind of was this embodiment of this possibility. And he very much played into that in order to, you know, he went on a world tour around his election, and he was very much tied to this period. And it also just seemed to be, I mean, it was when I was doing the majority of my field work too. So I caught kind of the Zuma era, where a lot of, particularly around sexual assault and around gender issues, there was a lot of disillusionment in these activism sectors. There was a lot of kind of an emergent patriarchy that kind of actively worked against some of the promises of the Constitution. And so it was very much, it felt like the end of an era. And also, even I talk about a soap opera that that starts in 1994 generations, and it also ended right after Nelson Mandela's death, and it's kind of, it echoes, and I talk about how that happens, but it echoes the trajectory of the nation in a way as well. And I think at the end, I'll talk a little bit about my next project that I'm thinking about these issues in terms of where we're going and what has happened since Nelson Mandela's death. But it seems like a very, very clear cut period of nation building and then kind of the rise and fall of people's own belief in the ANC, the African National Congress, and the democratic process.
You sort of mentioned this already, but I'm usually concerned with the possibility that our listeners might not have some of the context of the stuff that we discuss here. So could you just tell us briefly, like, how and when this idea of the Rainbow Nation comes about?
Sure. So the Rainbow Nation was first reference came out of the a series of sermons by Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, throughout the 80s, where he was traveling around the world and within the country at various times. And the Rainbow Nation is the idea that apartheid, which seemed kind of forever lasting, was actually just a storm, a passing storm, and once that had passed through the liberation of the country of South Africa, the rainbow of it's a very religious, obviously, a metaphor. The country's rainbow diversity and rainbow people, Desmond Tutu would say, rainbow people of God would come together and coexist in this kind of harmonious space, and that was taken up by that was in the 80s. And it's important to note that some of the most violent time of South Africa's apartheid era was in the last few years, right before democracy came, and in the late 80s and early 90s. So there was particularly between Xhosa ethnic group and Zulus, and there's a lot of shady things going on behind the scenes with the apartheid government trying to do some dividing politics. So this was also this unity and this idea of the rainbow of a variety of all sorts of different people, different colors, different, lives coming together to create this, the whole of South Africa was very appealing, both from a biblical perspective and also just kind of a conceptually, it was very powerful. And Nelson Mandela, when he, in his inauguration speech, said that South Africa, we are now a rainbow people, a rainbow nation at peace with ourselves and the world. That was kind of the dreamed vision of what the country could be, right? So even in its early days, this rainbow idea has always been aspirational, right? It's always this dream that of the country to come that has been, this is not even fully new. This is ongoing since this is what kept people fighting during the end, struggling to end apartheid, was the belief that South Africa could be truly, with the language that was used then, was non-racial, which I think backfired a little bit in how people think about it, but a multiracial, pluralistic society.
So, and then moving on from the Rainbow Nation to the other concept idea that you introduce already in the book's title, tell us a bit about the prism metaphor and how does that make us see or understand differently or even question the rainbow as a symbol, and what would be a prismatic performance?
Sure. So, the prism metaphor kind of works for me in opposition to this unified kind of flat diversity rainbow that that was projected, which of course creates this idea that the light refracts evenly to, and everybody gets their piece of the gold at the end of the rainbow. And so a prism, I just find, is conceptually interesting in that it deconstructs light. So it can create a rainbow, but it also works to show us the pieces that make the whole. It takes white light, which I think is also very interesting, and shows all the bits that come from it and how they, and the prism is also as a geode is, and as kind of a glass, is something that you can look through And what you see depends, and how you see things depends on where, how you're holding it. And also, I think if performances function as a prism, if particularly queer performances function, they really, their meaning shifts and depends upon how one engages, where one is standing, quite literally, but also the context, where one stands shapes one's interaction with both with the idea of queerness. And I also got this thought about it through the lens of the series that this is a part of, triangulations, right? Which is inherently refractive. So for instance, I'll give you two quick examples. So Stephen Cohen, who is I write about in the first chapter, is a drag, monster drag performer who is trying to critique his whiteness through abjection. And so when he's in spaces like galleries, or he has interventions where he shows up with like a butt plug and dressed as kind of like ugly, messy drag at like a fashion show, he's inherently disruptive, and he stands for kind of this critique, this outsider critique, specifically because that's a space of commerce and in that case whiteness. However, one of his most impactful interventions, he dresses like he wears a chandelier, and he walks into a squatter camp, into a space that his body is disrupting, but also carries with it the legacy, literal prisms here, reflecting the legacy of whiteness in that context. And kind of requires him to, and audiences who watch this piece, to really think about complicity and think about art and the meaning of art in spaces of dire poverty, of whiteness in spaces that were then happened at that time to be cleared by an urban renewal force that was trying to build a really pretty new Nelson Mandela Bridge. So that's a prismatic in that it depends on, you can see his work speaking vastly different things about queerness and whiteness and Africanness through that performance, those performances, depending on his position and his audiences and the interactions between the co-performances, if you will. But in a more, in a less artistic sense, I open and kind of bookend the book with discussion of a pride intervention that a Black lesbian activist group called the 1 in 9 campaign staged a die-in at the 2012 Johannesburg Pride March, and which on the whole of it is very well stage managed, and everybody, it looks super diverse and floats. It looks like could be pride anywhere, right? And there's lots of pop music and lots of like sports drinks and all those things. But this group of Black women cut across the route of the parade and asks for a moment of silence, and did kind of a die-in, a la, you might think of the work, things that, you know, ACT UP had done, where they lay their bodies down on the road and said, we need to acknowledge that Black lesbians are vulnerable to violence and sexual assault, and disproportionately, please give us a moment of silence. But the marchers, many of whom were white, and the whole Pride board was white, and this is where white people make 7 or 8% of the population now, only saw Black people stopping the parade, and they thought they were homophobes, even though these women clearly, from their signage and also just from the way they looked, were lesbians. And so the marchers started attacking the protesters and running their like floats through the signs and kicking and all this kind of the racism that had been underlying so much of this kind of pretty show of community togetherness immediately came out. People were saying, go back to your lokshins, which is locations, means townships, right? This is not your space. And then later people were like, when they found out that it was actually like a queer intervention, they said, oh, but they look like homophobes. And so it really showed that this automatic alignment in the minds of many, many white queer gay people, that Blackness equals homophobes equals, they were just invisible. These Black lesbians were invisible as lesbians because they only were seen as this kind of signifier of tradition that was seen as threatening to the pride and the script. And through that, everything became visible, and it was ugly, and people were fighting, and the whole pride kind of conglomeration collapsed because of this intervention, that if people had just recognized them and seen, you know, it for what it was, could have been a quick minute stop and then everybody continued. But because of the misrecognition, the multiple agendas and the racial politics and the class politics, because the place where it was being held was Zoo Lake Park, which is many people have to take multiple forms of public transportation, minibus taxis to get there, very far away from where the majority of Black South Africans in Johannesburg live. Yeah, all those things came out to the fore. And that's where a performance, a prismatic performance, breaks all of these pat narratives and kind of community idea, the patina of community. It breaks it into its parts, and you see all of the different presumptions and affects and attached to an investment in all these categories.
So those of us who investigate the Global South, right, have been asking whether or not, and I've, throughout this interview series, I've been discussing this with other folks, we've been asking whether or not or how is queer theory a useful framework to apply to some of the places, the people, the experiences that we investigate. And you bring up these debates in this book, so I was wondering what do you think about this? How do you deal with it? Can queer theory be applied as it has been in a Global Southern context, or should we be devising some theories or methods of our own? And you mentioned here that performance studies can help us. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, that's the question, right? And I think for me, it's very much about what is queer theory? What do we consider queer theory? And I think what our parameters are will change, you know, its relevance. I think that, and I talk a little bit about this, I think, in my introduction, that in the book, that some people have understandably said, you know, this is Western theoretical frameworks. They just are not relevant and are actually potentially colonial, which I would agree with. They can be. But I think there's also a danger of saying, you know, queer theory has no place in these conversations in the Global South. And I think that actually what good theory does, what we can do is find where theory exists within our own within the context we're writing about, and theorize from that and intervene and have, you know, conversations with these kind of more canonical Western based queer theorists and texts to intervene from a Global Southern perspective, from a localized perspective, and complicate those theories that we might see as being only for the North. And I think performance studies is really helpful for this because queer theory, what does that even mean anymore at this point? But like a lot of it, it's kind of had its earliest, some of its earliest works were very, very esoteric and are very literarily based. And I think what performance studies does is it draws attention and theorizes from and is attentive to the bodies in performance, bodies in relation to one another. And it can operate across any number of contexts and in fact prioritizes those with its kind of, and of course ethnography can be problematic, hashtag, but it also, because of it, it has a root in anthropology and theorizing from ethnographic lived experience. I think that can really counter these kind of, the theory that doesn't feel applicable and intervene from that located, closely observed and enacted position.
Yes. Thanks. Yeah, that was really helpful. I'm still trying to figure that out myself.
Yes, it's an ongoing question, definitely.
As you mentioned, right, each chapter focuses on a different facet of queer performance, and you are bringing the concept of performance to some sometimes even unexpected spaces or concepts. But the first chapter is the one that would fit in a more straightforward definition of performance. You talk about the work of two drag artists and their role in their responses to post-apartheid society and politics. But you know that while one of them bases his drag on not scaring the horses with unnecessarily confrontational approaches, The other has more of a fuck the horses approach. I love that definition. It really brought the point home. So can you talk about the similarities and differences in these performances and what are they doing?
Sure. So the first performer, the one who doesn't want to frighten the horses, and I think that's a little reductive, but is Peter Dirk Ace. And he's a satirist who has been performing during the apartheid since the 80s, been performing this character called Evita Bezuidenhout, who is very much like, you can think of a kind of analogous like Dame Edna Everidge. She is the wife of a high-ranking apartheid government official, and she becomes an ambassador to this independent imaginary homeland of Pepico Sweti. And basically during the 80s, when he was being censored, he did a lot of his criticism of the government through the character of Evita, because people would look and say, oh, it's just that silly drag, as he said, that silly drag queen again, forget it. And so he was able to, he created this whole mythology. He wrote like her biography. And she, as the one I was mentioning earlier, because she was really well known to a number of white audiences, by the time the ANC was coming to power, Nelson Mandela, he asked her to do an interview show where she would interview some of the new people who had been, the majority of people who were watching, the white audiences would perceive him as terrorists, as these kind of demonized figures. And so she goes in and kind of asks the dumb questions that people might be believing, and she models a sort of a conscientization, although she's still kind of ridiculous and silly, she becomes models this way of a new way of being white, or at least a way of finding space for whiteness in this new, at that time, new rainbow South African identity. And so her work is Peter Dirk Ace / Evita Bezuidenhout work is very much invested in the nation building project and trying to bring people over to the kind of religion of democracy. Whereas Stephen Cohen, who was a generation younger than Peter Dirk Ace, is very much of the Mr. Fuck the Horses, is really interested in not recuperating whiteness, but of trying to find ways to disempower and to reveal the ugliness of whiteness, and to disempower and objectivize isn't a word, but to kind of stretch the ways that white bodies can intervene with the new South Africa, and in ways that are very experimental and often upset the court, upset the apple cart. And okay, one really interesting thing about both of them that draws them together is not only they're both white, but they're both Jewish. And they kind of reflect a different, the complicated relationship that Jewish people had in South Africa, because they were considered fully, unlike most other places, not to say there wasn't anti-Semitism, but they were considered to be fully white. And so they were given all the privileges, access to everything, very high positions in industry and in the mining industries particularly. So you have this, and then also some of them became leaders, very important resistant leaders. And so, yeah, I think that they are, with these two actors where Ace is using drag in a way to kind of make whiteness absurd and also rethink what that could be and bring people on board. Stephen Cohen is showing that is dragging, literally dragging whiteness into and exposing all of its innards and its histories. And sometimes he, you know, using animal prosthetics and kind of thinking very much how, like in a Brechtian sense, how whiteness, how we understand all of these categories. And so essentially I argue that they both in different ways present whiteness as a queer form in some ways at its best, at its most, either, you know, it's most humble or it's most abject as being queer form of African identity. which is to say, not central, but part of the rest of this new country that was being formulated and understood at that time. But, and what I argue, and kind of this propels the majority of the book, is that, yes, they were very effective in doing, symbolically effective in their transformations and using drag performance as a way to imagine transforming whiteness. But there was never any sort of real restitution. There was never a reparations or economic change. So it's all good to have, like, you know, superficially think about whiteness. But if the economic structure remains the same, now people are in some ways economically worse off. The Gini coefficient is the highest in the world between the rich and the poor. So you can transform all you want, you can drag all you want, but if there isn't ongoing investment in change, then that transformation was incomplete. And you can see in the majority of the white South Africans still have access to power and money. You know, individual acts of transformation or of reconfiguration cannot make up for a lack of actual material change.
And so we move now from these white men in drag to a black lesbian soccer team. This is another yes. fascinating chapter. But I really, I enjoyed reading the whole chapter, but I was really interested in your concept of living as if. Could you talk about that, and how are you using it to understand these performances here?
So that chapter, I basically spent, when I was doing a year of field work in 2010, 2011, I spent 9 months just hanging out with this soccer team, which might seem like an odd kind of space for an activist organization. They came out of a group, the Organization Forum for Empowerment of Women. They're called The Chosen Few. But I was really interested in their role as out public lesbians, specifically in their communities, which were largely the townships, the kind of peri-urban areas around Johannesburg, and how they, because they moved with this soccer team through, they would go to the gay games, they go to Pride, they go to like community organizations. They were constantly, in some ways, code switching and moving, and were always perceived in very particular ways by their otherness. And this requires, being out in these very sometimes difficult and potentially dangerous circumstances required a lot, or I saw it as requiring them to take on a lot of like oversized persona and kind of live in what I call the as if, right? So they live as if their constitutional right is protected, is respected, and yet they are also kind of existing in this space where it's not. So they, by living in this kind of subjunctive way, they do this what I call projection and protection. It's like a double move where they create these personas, and they're out in their communities, and they are doing activism and really, really taking up space in very incredibly often brave ways. But they do that, but those identities also, those kind of larger than life personas protect them from the fact that, that their rights are not, yes, they have the constitutional rights, but their communities may or may not be accept them, or may accept them in ways that only see part of them. So it's a constant negotiation of themselves and claiming that space and holding it and creating and imagining the world they want to be able to live in, and in large ways carving out actual space with as a team. But it's always the world, I think activism is always in some ways, not aspirational, but, you're always trying to, it's utopic in a way. And you can't live in a utopia. And I think this is really for me, and this is where it's really helpful and where ethnography is really helpful, I find, to think about intervening into theory, because there's a lot, like a whole big thing in queer theory and performance theory about queer utopia, Munoz cruising utopia. And it's a great concepts. But what I argue is that utopia is never, you can't live in it. You might have glimpses, and that's the beauty of like Munoz's work, which is, I think inspires so many of us, is the idea of queer as this mesh of potentiality on the horizon that we never quite arrive at, but it's always there to be striven for. But it's what they do is an intervention, and the way that, not even just this group, but this group kind of gives us an insight into how people live in the not yet, vying for the as if, and live in that moment of potentiality while still also having, you know, one foot, if not an entire body, in our current world.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Myrtle Beach. You know what's better than getting away to a beach? Getting together at the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They've got over 2,000 restaurants, live music playing all day and night, and endless attractions. This place was made for playing hard and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 Miles Where You Belong. The beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Yes. Your third chapter focuses on the popular and artistic representations of this grotesque phenomenon that unfortunately many of us here in the Global South are familiar with, this idea of, and I'm using huge air quotes here, corrective rape. When you talk about the sexual violence and this paradox of lesbian invisibility, I would like you to talk a bit about this, and also, but how are the performances that you discuss here challenging or resisting this phenomenon?
Right. So the whole kind of, and I think your air quotes are very important here, because there's corrective rape and like capital letters. And then there's something that has a change.org petition and has become like this catchphrase for this particular act, which is, though used elsewhere, it very much is attached to South Africa and the global imaginary. And then the actual lived reality of women who, and in this case, we'll just say lesbian women to kind of LGBTQIA plus identified women, who are targeted to for sexual assault by men in their communities, with the idea, the kind of excuse that they just need a good man and that they're going to be corrected once they have this assault. But that's of course, one isn't possible, but also isn't an excuse for what is essentially kind of disciplining, right? And in a way, if we think about rape as an act, it's always about exerting power and control over certain bodies that are seen, often those that are seen out of moving out of their place. And so the phenomenon known as corrective rape, I think, is it puts Black lesbians specifically in a position where they are both hyper-visible as like this, because it is so grotesque, you know, it becomes one of those types of like special rape where you hear about it. But it also, so you'll like see it in the newspaper and see it, as I said, change.org. So it's hyper-visible, but even as you say it, because you are the phrase corrective rape, you're taking the position of the perpetrator, but in kind of reiterating it, it's meant to make lesbians invisible. And so it it really plays with the politics of visibility of the gays. And so any depiction or discussion about corrective rape, and I think would say just violence, sexual violence in general, particularly thinking about performance and representation, is always, you know, there's always the danger of re-traumatizing or of audiences kind of being like, ooh, right? Like, you can't look away because it's so awful. And then reiterating and reifying narratives of like, oh, those, you know, old colonial narratives about Black, to kind of riff off Gayatri Spivak, Black, you know, saving Black women, Black lesbians from Black men, that's white or global North people looking at. And so what the artists I look at in this chapter, photographer Zanele Muhori and choreographer and dancer Mamela Nyanza, each really deconstruct this the politics of watching in a way. So they, for instance, Zanele Moholi has a series of images called Only Half the Picture, which are of they, Zanele went by she, her, but now goes by they, them, has it come out as non-binary. And they were looking at taking pictures of Black lesbians going about their daily lives, but only kind of fragmented ways. So violence kind of creeps in and you'll see a scar, but it will be, you'll see someone in their everyday life. And on one hand, that's kind of the hyper invisibility of those things we don't see, or the invisible. I don't remember exactly how I did it. It's been a while. But and then she also took, they also took images of like a portrait series that was very much about Black lesbians, hyper visible. And staring at spectator and kind of returning that gaze. They've also done really interesting works with galleries that are very, very performative and have audio aspects and like in situ stages, and they're really expanding what we might think of as kind of photography. And then Mamela does this in collaborated with a Black British performer, Mojisola Adebayo, and in a play about this dance theater piece called I Stand Corrected, which is about this couple on their wedding day, and one of them is raped and murdered, Mamela's character, and the other is basically about Mojisola trying to find out what happened to her wife, her fiance, and it operates in like the two characters never exist in the same time period. One moves forward, the other moves back. But the play begins in this really interesting and excruciatingly painful dance of Mamela in a garbage, essentially like a trash bin, garbage can, where about 5 minutes she's kind of enacting the affects and the sounds, the movements of an assault, but it's displaced within this object. And she does that in several ways throughout. So you are feeling, watching this, you kind of, it's just dread as an audience member and kind of horror, but you're not actually seeing, it's not being like depicted straight on. So you kind of piece the parts together. And in both of these cases, you're, as an audience member, you are made to be aware of your own kind of reckoning with this body, that, and that you have, you have expectations of the of this Black lesbian, and when you are not fully given the narrative you expect, or when it is displaced on objects, you realize your own positionality in relation to that figure, and you're kind of, you look at your own process of watching, and your own desires to see that you've been projecting and thinking, and realize the kind of violence of the gaze, particularly when it is reflect, when what you want to see is denied you, you have to reflect on your own relationship.
After I read that chapter, I started looking up these performances, and they're really fascinating. Yeah, and then your final chapter is a virtual ethnography of the online response to a gay storyline on a popular soap opera. I'm Brazilian, so I was already, you know, already excited about this chapter. But I found that the discussion of virtual fandoms really inspiring because I'm also trying to look at a similar phenomenon. And you, as we talked, right, you're bringing the idea of performance to some unexpected spaces. Here you engage specifically with the audience. And as you say here, the triangulated relationship between audience, effect, and social change. So I'd like you to tell us what you mean by performative spectatorship.
Sure. So first, to give a little bit of background. Over the course of my many years of field work, visiting one full year and then several months every other year, there's a show, Generations, which I mentioned, that started in 1994 and ended in 2014, which we didn't know, but when I was doing this. But there was this, one of the most visible representations of gay characters in the public sphere was on the soap opera. But I couldn't find, I knew that like the world, like, pardon my French, the world like lost their shit when they saw this. Like everybody, this is something every family watches, very much like telenovelas and other contexts. Every night for like, the story never ends and they watch for decades. And I couldn't find anything to hold on to. And the soap opera itself, the storyline wasn't really that interesting. And they were going to charge me $50 per episode of the stinky soap opera when I talked to the South African Broadcasting Corporation. And I was frustrated. But then I found this website called Jen's Blog, GENSBLOG. Which was a fan site, and you would have, it was just the most amazing thing. It was people who would have for years would log on, mostly South African, kind of the black middle class who were working at various offices, but not just South Africa, because the soap opera broadcast across the continent. So you'd have people in Nigeria and all these different people logging in to talk about the soap opera. But it wasn't like just leave your message on the message board and then go away. People used it like a chat site. And so there was this archive of like hundreds of thousands of comments about these people who just talked all day. And they were using this virtual space as a way to first talk about the soap opera they loved, but also they started building relationships with each other and creating their own kind of family dynamic. And they called themselves the blog family. And you could see, people would be taking on the kind of melodrama of the soap opera, and they'd create characters that were a way to engage with their love of this melodramatic genre and this television show, but also in a way that built community and allowed them to kind of imagine themselves as part of this family, which mirrors and which would become a support system for people who felt very isolated. So it was very much kind of this post-apartheid phenomenon of people moving to big cities to make it good, to make it rich, very soap opera-y, and then feeling isolated and renting rooms and not having the family connection that they would have when they were at home. And so this online space became a familial space in a way over the course of years. And suddenly, so that's kind of how it just to think about like passion as fandom as where the audience becomes the performer and they perform for each other and with the shared kind of script of the soap opera and its trope, which they love. So I got really into just like digging into this and discovering these own people with their soap opera lives how they dramatize themselves. But this was also a great sight to see the reaction people had to this kiss on the soap opera, where the beginning of the gay storyline, where it radically shattered this community that had, by that point, had its norms, had its rituals, and different people were just like having, suddenly the rhetoric changed and people were like talking about fire and brimstone. And then other people were saying, well, you know, this is just how life is. And it became this community in a crisis, essentially, where people, I think one of the people said, you know, I think we're falling apart. And for me, it was a really, really unique example of an opportunity to think about reception in a kind of three-dimensional sense, as not just someone watches and not just passive, but as audience reception as being an active, shifting, collective thing. And so, yeah, it was, and watching, it also allowed you to see by tracing these same people over this website and their relationships, and they you could see how they made space for this intersecting identity South Africanness or Africanness and, you know, homosexuality. And there's this truism that I reference throughout my book, or it's kind of it's widely accepted belief that homosexuality is un-African. It's a phrase that gets repeated, or not part of our African culture, as if that is one thing. And so I look at that. But what it does in this space is they have to create a space where these seemingly oppositional or previously oppositional categories can coexist. And that is because of the genre itself, and the show that has been running since 1994, and they've been watching it probably the majority of their lives. These characters are real for them, and they are projecting themselves onto the characters and into this kind of super cosmopolitan Johannesburg, but also they've projected themselves into this other community, this parallel online community, where they have built really meaningful relationships. And so I get really into the prism metaphor here about like refraction and reflection, refraction and diffraction, which is kind of comes out of feminist science studies, where there is for some reason a blockage of the light, right? The metaphorical prism. And the light and the beam has to reform itself around the blockage. And so essentially, I think that's a helpful way of thinking about how change happens when something is so disruptive that it cannot go on as it did before. The chat room, but also these individuals had to make space, unless they were going to give up the show they'd been watching their whole life. And some people did. Some people never came back. But a lot of people did. And a lot of people made space to find acceptable, you know, whether it was feminizing the gay man. So it's not like suddenly everybody became the greatest allies and like super pro-gay. But then you also had gay people coming to the website for the first time. And there's a really interesting relationship between these two posters, T-Boz and ZZ, where ZZ is, T-Boz has kind of goes from like seeing himself as like the big, as being very proud of his homophobia. And he's kind of like the big man of the chat room, because mostly it's women, but he really begins to at least express respect for ZZ, asking him questions. And this poor guy, ZZ, who says he worked at the SABC as a kind of in a lower level, and they get to know each other as people, and you can see him coming, T-Boss coming around to that, and then ZZ eventually leaves, because I imagine that's not a fun thing to have to go and feel like you're trying to constantly explain or justify your existence. But it's like that just were like, we so rarely get to see change. We always talk about, you know, the audience feels this, or the audience, you know, and it's incredibly hard to really track how people's perceptions change over time, especially with performance. And that's why I think this is a helpful lens. And so this was an archive where you could see shifting attitudes, and particularly you could see people creating spaces for queerness in their ideas of African culture. And also, and I think because of the melodrama and the affect and the projection of themselves so intensely into the soap opera, and also it reenacting it and creating their own soap opera in a virtual space, they were able to shift. Opinions shifted. Now, what that means in the long term, who knows? But just was such an interesting site, and I would never have discovered it if they had just, like, the SABC had just made those episodes available to me. I might have done something completely different. But it gave me a way to tap into what I knew as and for those who are, you know, researchers. You know, sometimes there are things you know have happened. Like, this was really incredibly important to how people perceived gay couples, a nightly show where it was normalized and where you saw the struggle, the homophobia of the father, right? It's all about familial drama and dynamic. The father attacks the son's boyfriend, and then he becomes an alcoholic, but then he comes around eventually. And everybody by that point, everybody who was like, yeah, I would have beaten him too, are like, come on, man, just forgive him. Let's bring peace to the family, right? And so we can move on to another storyline about Katiwe shooting her baby, whatever the ridiculous soap opera spots are. And it was just a lovely, unexpected discovery during the research. That that's one of my favorite parts of the whole project, was just really, really diving deep into this space and seeing how people performed for each other in this prismatic space where multiple types of projection and engagement, even if it's disembodied, in some ways that makes it easier, where these things were really, really shifting and where attitudes were changing.
Yeah, that's a fascinating chapter and an incredible use of netnography. I caught myself really invested in the plot lines that were developing in the board, like less so than the ones in the actual soap opera. And there's so much more that I would love to ask you about, but I think we're running out of time. But before you go, could you share with us what you're working on next?
Sure. Let's see. So I've been really, really interested, and this is just the beginning of a project. I unfortunately have been having trouble, you know, pandemic and then carving out time. But one of the most interesting and exciting things that has happened in South Africa in the past 5 years, I would say, is this student movement that began with a statue of Cecil Rhodes on the University of Cape Town's campus, and a Black student who was just angry and frustrated took poop and excrement and threw it at the statue and then documented it, put it on social media. And it created a movement around removing the statue, right? Which is, I think, something that's happening across the world right now, this idea that these symbols must go. But one of the really most interesting things about this movement to remove Rhodes, which was called Rhodes Must Fall initially, and then it took off across the country, so then it became Fees Must Fall. The most interesting about this movement was it was young and explicitly feminist. Many of the leaders were queer. And it was a decolonial movement that differed in some ways from a lot of the other, you know, colonial, decolonial or anti-colonial movements of earlier times, in South Africa and elsewhere in the continent and perhaps the world, where they often, you know, it's about Fanon, it's about, you know, these great men. But this particular iteration was very much led by women and trans people, who were leaders and also artists, and it really had interventions with the statue. And it was very different because, you know, as Prismatic Performances says, the gay movement with, you know, capital G mostly, has largely been led by white people, even though they're a tiny fraction of the population, because they are the ones with money, and they can access these like gayborhood spaces and live that life. But this is very much linking sexual diversity, queerness, to a radical root from the bottom up movement of what it means to decolonize the university, but also knowledge and the country. South Africa never, I mean, these youth largely think that it was that transition to democracy was a compromise, and that Nelson Mandela was a sellout. And these are all people who were born this century and have a lot of like, and are online constantly. And so the whole thing was broadcast, and they are also in dialogue with Black Lives Matter and other similar organizations elsewhere. And I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with this yet. And you have to write like grant applications and things. And so I always sound like I have a really great sense on what I'm going to do, but I'm just really interested in how this pushes how we understand the relationship between queerness and decoloniality and social movements, and also social media. And there's also a play that my little theater bit here. There's a play called The Fall that's basically a docudrama that's been incredibly successful, traveled the world, created by a group of students who were there at the protest, and they've translated the whole thing into this theater piece that's really incredibly powerful. And just thinking about what does it mean for this, for an event to circulate and online, and also embodied and re-performed in different ways in different locations, and how does that, do the locations they travel to, you know, and how did those audiences interact with it? And so they were in DC, and I saw them perform a couple times, and they, you know, when it was in the fallout after the Charlottesville protests around statues. And just, I just think there's so much interesting kind of synergy globally, but specifically centering this as a case study of all these complicated, exciting new ways to imagine queerness and decoloniality.
It is an incredible movement and phenomenon, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do with it, what you're going to write. And I hope that if you have another book out, you'll come see us and talk to us here.
It'll be my first port of call. Thank you. No, it's, as I was saying, it's just been so wonderful to be in conversation again, after so much distance and difficulty. I'm really glad that outlets like this exist. And I really appreciate your engagement with the work and making this happen.
And I'm really thankful for your time today and for talking to me. As we were discussing, and as I've mentioned in a previous interview, I'm a historian, so I count on the brilliant work of performance scholars to help me understand my own work. So thank you.
And we really count on the brilliant historiography that gets done. I think that's something I would love to learn more about. So you'll have to let me know when your book comes out.
I will, and we'll definitely keep in touch. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. And I just spoke with Dr. April Sizemore-Barber about prismatic performances, queer South Africa, and the fragmentation of the Rainbow Nation, which was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2020. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.